I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. This is Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. When Donald Trump was campaigning to be president in 2016, he frequently called the North American Free Trade Agreement the worst trade deal ever made.
I'm going to tell our NAFTA partners that I intend to immediately renegotiate the terms of that agreement to get a better deal by a lot, not just a little, by a lot for our workers.
That's from a June 2016 campaign stop in Pennsylvania. Trump claimed that because of NAFTA, the U.S. racked up over $2 trillion in trade deficits and lost millions of manufacturing and auto jobs. Then, on November 30th, Trump joined then-Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in Buenos Aires to sign the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement.
With our signatures today, we will formally declare the intention of our three countries to replace NAFTA with the USMCA. The USMCA is the largest, most significant, modern, and balanced trade agreement in history.
Trump says the USMCA will support high-paying manufacturing jobs in the U.S. and provide greater access for American exports. He also said the three nations will promote higher wages for North American auto workers and prevent auto jobs from moving overseas. It's easy to paint the relationship between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada solely along those lines, manufacturing and automotive jobs, or even the ongoing partisan battle over illegal immigration and border security. But the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico in particular is broader than we might imagine. For example, those loaves of Sara Lee bread and the Thomas English muffins on your grocery store shelves are produced by Bimbo, a Mexico City-based company. Mexican-owned Mission Foods, which makes the tortillas we eat with our breakfast tacos, runs plants in the U.S. And Arca Continental, which makes cheese doodles and the official potato chip of the New York Mets and Boston Red Sox, also a Mexican company. Andrew Seeley is president of the Migration Policy Institute, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank that supports liberal immigration policies. Seeley is the author of Vanishing Frontiers, The Forces Driving Mexico and the United States Together. Seeley says that in the 25 years since NAFTA, the economies and cultures of the U.S. and Mexico have become intertwined, and the ties can be as small as an immigrant who launched a successful restaurant to as impactful as the Mexican business that saved the U.S. nail industry. Seeley says that pre-NAFTA, Mexico wasn't much on America's mind, and vice versa.
I think for President Bush, you know, may he rest in peace, he had proposed to Mexico, and President Reagan had, doing a trade agreement, but Mexicans had never been interested. And President Bush had the prescience to understand that this was a new world and that the U.S. would do well to tie itself closer to its neighbors to the north and the south. But it also turned out to be really good for the three economies. I mean, it turned out to create a shared platform for economic production, even more than trade, a shared platform where we make things like cars and refrigerators together. But there were some real tough adjustments that happened along the way. And that's why people were so nervous. I mean, that, you know, for Mexicans, they were worried that U.S. companies would put them out of business. Obviously, in the United States, the concern was that you would see these U.S. companies take their production to Mexico and there'd be no manufacturing left in the United States. There'd be the giant sucking sound, as Ross Perot talked about. Both of those things did happen to some extent. I mean, not as much as the critics feared, by any means, but we have to acknowledge there were some companies that moved their factories to Mexico. It still happens. There were some Mexican companies that went under because they couldn't compete. But what came out on the other side is we see Mexican companies learning to compete and beginning to invest in the United States and creating jobs. And we see American companies actually putting parts of manufacturing on both sides of the border so that they can compete globally. And the auto industry is it's probably the biggest part of this. The auto industry, back in the 1980s, before NAFTA was signed, right around the time NAFTA was signed, actually in the early 90s, the fear was that everyone was going to be making cars in Japan and Korea and Europe and we'd all be driving around imported cars in the United States. Instead, most cars we drive in the United States are actually made in North America, mostly in the United States, mostly U.S. content still. They were able to become trinational and become competitive in the global economy.
Well, Andrew, in your book, Vanishing Frontiers, you mentioned that Mexico essentially saved the nail industry in the United States. But ever since President Trump decided to enforce tariffs, it looks like that nail industry might just go out of business. Could you take us back how it was that that Mexican investment helped save the nail industry and how that's changed today?
I mean, that is one of my favorite stories in the book, and it's one that I didn't run across until I was in the middle of writing it, actually. And I was looking for ways of explaining these economic interconnections, and someone brought my attention to Mid-Continent Nails in southeastern Missouri. And Mid-Continent Nails is the last big nail plant in the United States. U.S. nail industry has mostly gone out of business because imported nails, mostly from China, are a lot cheaper. And Mid-Continent was also about to go, the owner was looking for a buyer, wasn't sure he could keep competing. And he ends up selling the company to a Mexican company called De Acero that's their steel supplier. And De Acero realizes that they could actually make Mid-Continent competitive because they've got steel in northern Mexico. They save the American nail industry. And not only that, they expand the jobs, they expand production. You know, you have more American-made nails than ever before, made by more American workers in southeastern Missouri than ever before. And then along comes the steel tariffs on Mexico and Canada, which is ironic because Mexico actually imports more steel from the U.S. than exports steel to the U.S. And Mid-Continent suddenly becomes less productive because now there are tariffs on the steel. What made this work in the same way the auto industry works so well is that you don't have tariffs and you have this sort of seamless production going on between people on both sides of the border. So now American workers are actually in danger of losing their jobs in Missouri because of steel tariffs on Mexico.
Is there any sign that those tariffs may be lifted?
I think so. I think the negotiations are ongoing, especially since we have now agreed to a new NAFTA among the three countries. You know, that's the kind of thing that you'd want to fix in the context of, you know, ensuring that you really do have seamless integration among the three countries. And, you know, the thing about NAFTA, or now the USMCA, as it's going to be called, the US-Mexico-Canada agreement, you know, we've always talked about it as trade. I mean, there's a lot of agricultural trade. There's some industrial trade. But about half of what's going on that we call trade is really shared manufacturing. It's goods and parts moving across the border as we're making things together in factories on both sides of the border, or in all three countries, actually, with Canada. So it really is as much a shared production agreement as it is a trade agreement.
You've brought up the USMCA. What are the differences between NAFTA and the USMCA, which, like you mentioned earlier, it's the new NAFTA? What was it about the old NAFTA that needed to be changed? What tweaks have been made? And maybe what's completely different in this new proposed agreement?
You know, it's surprisingly similar, to be honest. I mean, it's hard to find a lot of differences. There certainly are some things that weren't in the original agreement, like e-commerce, that are in there, which matter because that's actually a big part of the economy these days. Energy, which has become a major area of trade between the two countries, and both Mexican oil coming north to the U.S., but actually U.S. natural gas going south to Mexico and electricity across the border. And probably the biggest tweak, the one that President Trump has talked about, is more content made in North America, particularly for cars. Certainly what it'll do is prevent more of the auto industry moving to Mexico in the future, which is something that some people feared might happen. But those are the real differences. I actually described it as a zonkey. If you go down the streets of Tijuana, there are these things called zonkeys, which are donkeys painted like zebras. And, you know, I described USMCA as sort of NAFTA painted with stripes, sort of like a zonkey. And you know, there aren't that many differences, really. But the industrial provisions on cars may be beneficial in the long term, particularly for American industry.
That's Andrew Seeley, president of the Migration Policy Institute and author of Vanishing Frontiers, The Forces Driving Mexico and the United States Together. When we come back.
I mean, there really is a huge investment by immigrants in starting businesses. Immigrants are twice as likely to start a new business as a native-born American.
More of our conversation with Andrew Seeley is coming up next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. We're talking this half hour with Andrew Seely, president of the Migration Policy Institute and author of Vanishing Frontiers, The Forces Driving Mexico and the United States Together. In the book, Seely describes the kickstart the Mexican oil industry received under its previous president, Enrique Peña Nieto. Prior to the Peña Nieto administration, Mexico was only able to draw oil revenue from its national company, Pemex. Peña Nieto opened up the industry to privatization and U.S. investment. Here's Peña Nieto in 2013.
La transformación de Pemex,
he says here, quote, "The transformation of Pemex is indispensable for the liberation of the great economic potential of our country," end quote. Andrew Seely says the Mexican oil industry is a central point of pride for Mexico, and the new Mexican president, Andrés López Manuel Obrador, is looking to make his own changes.
I mean, this was the beginning of the Peña Nieto administration, so just about 6 years ago, one of the first things they did was go through and allow for the first time private investment in the energy market. And this is radical because part of what modern Mexican nationalism was based on was this moment in history in 1938 where the Mexican government under then-President Lázaro Cárdenas nationalizes the oil industry. And Cárdenas very wisely sees that there's a world war coming up and that the U.S. is probably not going to push back if he does this. So he nationalizes the oil industry and the U.S. doesn't really push back because they need Mexico and Mexico's oil for the coming war. But this is really deeply embedded in Mexico's narrative about itself, about sort of taking back the country's natural resources. There was this one national oil company, Pemex, that was responsible for all extraction of oil and gas, and it became a fountain of corruption and inefficiency over time. And so what Peña Nieto did was allow private investment to come in. There's a huge sea change going on in the energy market. Mexico gets over half of the natural gas that the U.S. exports. And so all these things have been pretty good. López Obrador comes out of a more nationalist point of view. He's distrustful of private enterprise being involved in energy. And so what he said he's going to do is respect the contracts that exist for private companies, but he's not going to keep down this path of allowing greater private investment until he sees results.
Going to the topic of drug cartels and cartel violence, a partnership exists between the United States and Mexico, you know, to help track down where cartel members are, law enforcement, etc. But the new Mexican president, López Obrador, is saying he wants to emphasize the roots of crime instead of directly fighting the cartels. And if I understood this correctly, he divided Mexico into a number of regions into which he's going to deploy hundreds of Mexican Marines, but he is not actively going to be fighting those drug cartels. Is that going to endanger the existing relationship, the existing policies between the U.S. and Mexico when it comes to fighting drug violence?
It reminds me a little bit of Barack Obama when he became president of the United States and back in 2009 and said, you know, we're immediately going to withdraw our troops from Iraq. You know, we're going to focus on Afghanistan. And as soon as he came in, he started talking to the military, the intelligence community. He realized that that would be a disaster for people in Iraq. And so he ends up actually having to figure out to pursue a different strategy to try and ensure long-term public security in Iraq. I think López Obrador is going through something similar right now. I mean, he has said he's not going to use the military, he's not going to use the police, that this is all about development. But he shifted in the inauguration speech, and he actually spoke for about 5 minutes about the military and why he was going to rely more on the military. But we're going to see a more nuanced strategy, because I don't think you can deal with organized crime just by investing in development. People don't become criminals just because they don't have money. The criminal organizations have the ability to buy people off, to threaten people. You know, people join for other reasons, and you can't respond to that just through development, unfortunately. I mean, it'd be great if you could.
Well, Andrew, we can't talk about the connections between U.S. and Mexico without talking about immigration. And I know migration from Central America has been mostly in the news, and a good number of those migrating from Central America are those seeking asylum, fleeing gang violence, etc. Whereas a lot of the immigration that had been coming from Mexico, it was mostly, and I'm generalizing a lot here, so people can find work. And a lot of the Mexican immigrants in the U.S., have established a lot of jobs. And you point out in your book that immigrants have a really high rate of entrepreneurship compared to those who are born in the United States. I think you had mentioned that 1/10 of all businesses in the U.S. are started by immigrants.
Yeah, it's quite surprising. I mean, there really is a huge investment by immigrants in starting businesses. Immigrants are twice as likely to start a new business as a native-born American. And, you know, a lot of that is, you know, you figure self-selection, right? People are, you know, moving to another country, they're taking a risk, you self-select risk takers. But we are facing a different group of immigrants coming in. I mean, the Central Americans are much more driven by violence and driven by fear of bad things happening to them in a way that was not true of the earlier flows of Mexicans. They're much more young people and families as well. Mexico was used to being a country that was sending migrants abroad. And now suddenly they have immigrants coming into the country, some of whom want to stay in Mexico, some who want to pass through to the U.S. And so there is a real set of conversations going on about how do you increase asylum access for people in Mexico as well as in the United States? Do you try and deter people who don't have visas, or do you try and create work-based programs? I think López Obrador has said he wants to do, create a work-based program for Central Americans to come and work in Mexico. How much do you collaborate with the U.S. on border control? These are all issues the new government's facing, and they don't really have a roadmap for this yet. They're figuring it out for the first time.
Well, going back to the Mexican immigrants in the United States who have been working and sending their money back home, you point out in your book that the small rural towns that the immigrants moved away from, they left their families behind. And again, they sent their money back, and they actually helped transform the economies of some of those small rural towns. And so could you tell us a story that you had in the book about maybe just one of those cities that was transformed by people who had to move away to make a living and to help support their families?
Sure. I mean, I have two different stories in the book about this because it's such a fascinating area. One's in the introduction, actually, which follows a man named Demetrio Juarez, who lives in Hazleton, Pennsylvania. And Demetrio is fascinating. He is the oldest of seven children, and he and his father migrate. His father migrates first. He follows his father. But it turns out none of his siblings have migrated. His six brothers and sisters, five of them have college degrees. One has a technical degree. All have stayed back in their home state of Puebla in Mexico. And you know, they all have these middle-class lives, but still living in the same town that they grew up in. This is the same thing that happened in Italy. It's the same thing that happened in Ireland and in Poland, right? As people migrated and sent money back, they end up being able to help family members so they don't have to migrate. And ironically, you know, as I was back home telling some of my relatives in Denmark about this story, one of my aunts pulls out a book and shows me the story of a great uncle of mine who had migrated from Denmark in the early part of the 20th century to New York, made money, came back, and was the money that then pulled the family out of poverty. And this was how the rest of the family, no one else migrated until my mother did. No one else migrated because, you know, the money that he had earned in New York was enough to actually allow the family to buy land and have a farm. This is how it works, and it's worked well for Mexico. It will hopefully work at some point for Central America as well.
Well, Andrew, I know that you can't really predict what's going to happen. We have a couple of years left in the Trump administration. We have a brand new administration in Mexico. I'm not sure what the term is for Justin Trudeau up in Canada, but since your book was published in 2018, how do you foresee maybe the next couple of years here? What's left of the Trump administration? How do you see the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico in particular changing in these next couple of years?
You know, it's fascinating because I think Mexico and the U.S. are becoming much more similar to each other. Not the same. I mean, certainly culturally very distinct, different languages, different histories. But, you know, Mexico is becoming a more developed country. Mexico has more poverty still. I mean, you know, there are differences. The U.S. is a global power. Mexico isn't. But increasingly, Mexico is a middle-income country. It's even a high middle-income country. It's got a big middle class. Mexico is becoming more of an immigrant society than a migrant-sending society. There are more people that either are Mexicans that return home. There are somewhere around 1 million Americans who live in Mexico, as well as Central Americans moving in. So they have the same issues on immigration. And I think President Trump won in part because he was able to use Mexico as a metaphor for globalization. You know, he used Mexico effectively to speak to fears people have about America's insertion in the world. And, you know, you now have a president in Mexico who's also a nationalist. He's a leftist nationalist, but he's also a nationalist. But, you know, the U.S. under the Trump administration keeps asking Mexico to do more to contain people in Mexico. The Mexican government's willing to do that. They actually are looking at ways of bringing in Central Americans and allowing them to stay in Mexico. But I have a feeling the Trump administration is going to overreach and try and push Mexico into a corner that they can't get out of. And you're going to see López Obrador responding quite negatively because he's also a nationalist. And I think the next couple of years, you know, could be tense on the political side. And at the same time, you're going to have lots of collaboration going on day to day between border communities. The economic relationship will continue to get even more intense, and, you know, more cars will be made and more tortillas will be sold in the United States and more nails, and things will go well. But in the political side, I think we may see some fireworks over the next couple of years because you have leaders in both countries who really want to double down on their sense of national identity.
We've been talking with Andrew Seely, president of the Migration Policy Institute and author of Vanishing Frontiers, The Forces Driving Mexico and the United States Together. You can hear more of our conversation on TPR.org, including a chat about an international bridge linking airports in the U.S. and Mexico, and the natural disaster that led the Mexican army to cross the U.S. border for only the second time since the Mexican-American War. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Fernando Ortiz Jr. is our editor, and Vince Kong is our digital editor. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.